Before we get any further into the interview, I want to give a shout out to our partnering nonprofit festival for this series, Festability. As a board member, I helped put together a wonderful event in St. Louis at the Missouri History Museum. We will have so many activities and vendors set up all over with an amazing headliner for our main stage. This year, I will be opening for Tony Award-winning actress Ali Stroker. Festability is the best event in St. Louis to celebrate your disability unapologetically. Make sure you come out later this year on October 7, 2023 from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. Thank you, Festability, for sponsoring the series. Now, back to the show.
Awful, awful. And you also highlighted why I beg my family not to come in the doctor's office with me, because I won't get talked to. It's like I'm not even there.
I don't understand. Like, it infuriates me that we are people, we are humans, we are able to communicate, and just because you are not communicating verbally doesn't mean you can't communicate. And it also highlights how something I always talk about, when people equate speech, quality of speech or lack of speech, with intelligence, and one thing has nothing to do with the other.
Yeah, completely separate, completely not, yeah. And, you know, and even for people who, you know, medical professionals may say are not as intelligent, they can still communicate in a variety of ways, and they still deserve to be heard. Absolutely. So what can doctors do better? I know there's a lot to it, but what is something, especially for any doctors listening, what is something they can hold on to? What can they do better to listen to their disabled patients and their chronically ill patients?
I think you just said it, listening to their patients, like listening and really listening. And when we tell you, hey, something is off, like paying attention to that. Like, how many times did I have to tell my doctor, you know, this is not right, this is not right. And like the PA at the gastroenterologist asking me, well, who told you you had a gluten allergy? Well, my body told me. I live in my body every day. You know, we go to the doctor, see us once, maybe twice a year, if we're lucky, for about 10 minutes. So they don't know what we deal with on a daily basis. And we need people to listen to us, truly, truly listen, and go beyond their lab tests. Go further, dig further, because ironically, this morning, I was telling my roommate, I said, you know, I recently got my thyroid meds adjusted, but I still feel like something is off. And when I got diagnosed with hypothyroidism, that was it. No more tests were done, because when they put me on thyroid medication, my thyroid levels evened out, but they never did more testing. And I'm like, what if there's something much more to what I have rather than just hypothyroidism? Obviously, alongside my chronic illness, but specifically dealing with my thyroid. So it's like, dig deeper. Don't just look at your labs and say, oh, your labs look good, you're free to go. If I'm telling you I don't feel well, there's a reason why I'm telling you I don't feel well.
Right. Right. Yeah, if I'm saying there's something more to it, then, you know, there's probably, Yeah, there's definitely something more to it. And so specifically for CP, you talked about how, well, in general, how medical ableism and racism can result in us just not getting treated at all or getting minimal treatment. So are there any treatments or solutions that you are wanting for CP or needing for CP?
I think what all I want to know is what my body's gonna do at 55 and 60 with cerebral palsy. Tell me that. That's what I want to know. And also, tell me how CP at 60 is going to interact with all of my chronic illnesses. I am not entirely convinced, Sean, that there's no link to chronic illness, between chronic illness and CP. I am not convinced that there is not one. There has to be. There has to be, with the level of fatigue that we go through, there has to be a link between chronic fatigue syndrome and cerebral palsy. Like, if you have cerebral palsy, at some point you develop chronic fatigue syndrome. I truly, in my heart, believe it's there. And what I'm wanting is more research in adults. And when I say adults, I mean 30s and 40s and 50s. Because when you're in your teens and 20s, your body's still changing, right? So it doesn't help with what your body's going to do at 40 or 50. But when you start to do research on those who are 35 and up, then that is going to help people in your age category know what it's going to be like for them when you reach my age or older.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And also, this all reminds me of when I broke my femur. It was the worst pain of my life. And this nurse came in to give my pain medication. She connected the syringe to my feeding tube. She did this correctly, but it all went on my skin. So the nurse left and I looked at my mom, shaking my head, immediately saying, nothing went in. And I'm not bullshitting. I know nothing went in my stomach. And so we told the nurse. The bitch didn't believe me. And they had to pull my cover back, and the sheets were all pink from the medicine that never went in.
I'm not surprised. I'm not surprised one bit, like, at all. It's like, you know, so, like, for me, with my chronic illness, the pain scale, but the regular pain scale from 1 to 10, right? But when you have chronic illness, that pain scale will help a window. Because my baseline, if I got the baseline, I would be so happy. My baseline is a 5. Now, most people, a 5, they would be like at immediate care in the ER because they'd be in so much pain, right? But I'm used to that, like, that's the level of pain I'm used to. From day to day, so like the day we're recording this right now, I would have to say, because of the weather and everything, and because I'm tired today, my pain is between a 7 and an 8. And that's normally where I am. And on really bad pain days, it's an 8 or 9. And yes, I've been at a 10 before. I would have to say, when I was going through all of that with that medication that the rheumatologist gave me, I was at a 10. When that cyst on my ovary burst, I was definitely at a 10. I was literally double over in pain. I also have endometriosis, which causes very painful periods before you get your period. It's extremely painful. I have so many things that cause me pain, but I'm used to being at a 7. I'm used to being at 8. I shouldn't have to be used to that. And the fact that we are never believed, like, whenever I go to a doctor's appointment and they ask me about pain, I have to be very clear to them. I have chronic pain. I have chronic illness. My baseline is a 5. So when I tell you I'm at a 7, you need to understand what that means. Because otherwise, oh, can I tell the story real quick about this therapist? Okay.
Yes.
After I had my injury that I talked about earlier, I went for a lot of like therapy, a lot of rehab. I had to go occupational therapy. I had this occupational therapist who told me that there was no way I could be at 8 for pain. There was no way. And that she touched my arm, Sean. Mind you, this is a white woman. I have to throw it in there because the black occupational therapist I had never did this to me. But this white woman takes my arm, Sean, and puts her fingertips in my arm. Like the pads of her fingertips, I'm pointing to the pads of my fingertips. The pads of her fingertips and pushes them into my skin and left her fingerprints on my skin because my fibromyalgia was flaring that day. And after she did that, she said, oh, your fibromyalgia really is flaring today.
Wow. Yeah, wow. What the fuck? Because you literally just said it. You just said it. You just said it. So, and you know that for me, I just want my left hand cut off because it's useless. One time I was relaxing in bed, typing on my phone, and my left hand started cramping. I looked over and it was on its back, giving me the middle finger. I couldn't even open my hand up.
I have a problem if I tell again with your client fatigue. I'll go to the bathroom and I will honestly just sit in the bathroom for way longer than I should because I'm just too tired to get up, right? And I'm like, okay, I have to get up. And I'm so tired. And by the time I get up, my feet are so numb, they hurt. I have pins and needles in my feet. And I'm just like, okay. And yeah, I know my left arm is my weakest side. I don't want to cut off because I can still use it a tiny, tiny bit. But I get frustrated. It just, you know, yeah, it's just so frustrating. So frustrating.
Yeah. So how do you feel about the doctors who are looking for a quote unquote cure for CP? And would you do it if it were like medically possible?
Okay. No, I would not. Because I love my disabled body. As much as it frustrates me, and boy, does it frustrate the hell out of me. And sometimes we have a love-hate relationship. No, I won't do it because me accepting a cure for cerebral palsy is telling the non-disabled world that there's something wrong with having cerebral palsy. And there's nothing wrong with having cerebral palsy. There's nothing wrong with being disabled or being in a disabled body. So, no, I definitely would not. I would like doctors to focus on a cure for cancer, a cure for lupus, these chronic illnesses that shorten my life. That's what I want them to focus on, not because they think I need to be non-disabled. No, absolutely not.
Yeah. And that's important, right? Because it's like, disabled and chronically ill people, we deserve to live. And, you know, Yeah, so the idea of a cure, the idea of there not being any more people with CP, not exciting, not an exciting idea, because that really just invalidates the human experience of so many people.
And can I just say this? If they are working for a cure for cerebral palsy, that leads me to believe that CP does not start when you are born. It must start in the womb, which is something I've always wondered about. Because for years, it was like, so for me, personally, you know, it was the lack of oxygen when I was born that caused brain damage, and it affected the side of my brain that deals with the left side of my body, so my right brain. It damaged the right side of my brain, right? So if you're talking about, oh, we're going to cure it, that means you know what caused it, which again, it leads me to believe it, that they say, oh, it's not genetic, or oh, it just happened. No. There's more to it. And it's like, so here's my thing. I'm big on conspiracy theories. You have to know that about me. That's just how I am. I guess they have always happened. But I guess I've always, like, as an adult, I've always said, there's more to CP than they're laying on than we, the general public, know. Sorry, how to say that?
Yeah. I mean, to your point, there is not a whole lot of research about the life cycle, the full life cycle of someone with CP. So that mystery there, yeah, there's something there. There's something to it. And I feel like, you know, just it's eugenics in disguise, right? The motivation to eliminate CP from the human experience, right?
Well, why do you think they do amniocentesis to find out if a baby has Down syndrome? Same reason. Because now, I will say, if you choose not to have a baby, that is your choice. I am not saying that. That is not what I'm talking about. What I'm saying is, if you say, I don't want a disabled child, and you find out you're going to have a disabled child, and you choose to abort because you're going to have a disabled child, and that is the only reason, not because there are social and economic impacts that having a disabled child brings. If you are impoverished, if you are not going to be able to care for that child, there's so many nuances to that, but the wanting to get rid of disability, that is what I don't agree with.
Yeah. And thank you for pointing out that really important nuance about body autonomy and how that comes together in this conversation about treatments and cures and things like that. So shifting gears to your work, how did it feel to be an honoree in Diverse Abilities D30 list? You deserve it so much.
It was amazing. It's like, the one thing I always say is like queer, brown, disabled women with impaired speech, like we don't get those things, right? Like that can just fall into your lap. Now, if you're white, disabled, and you're powerful, and you've got nice aesthetic, yeah, that might fall in your lap. But like for me, definitely not. And I always say, I need as many accolades and acknowledgments and titles as possible. And that is not me being an attention seeker. What I am saying is, for me to be taken seriously, I have to have the award. I have to have the acknowledgments. I have to have these titles. So having that title of DJ honoree behind my name has opened some doors for me. Which I'm very, very, I was honored to be on the list. And I'm just thrilled that, yeah, it was a big, I know some people might think it's no big deal, but to me, it was definitely a big deal.
Yeah, it's a big deal and you deserved it. And you're right, absolutely. When you are, you know, multi-marginalized or marginalized, people tend to require receipts. People tend to require some kind of what they would deem to be proof, acceptable proof of our skills, of our knowledge, of our deserving to be there, of our deserving to be honored.
Can you imagine just having a name and being able to walk into a room and occupy space just because your name? That's it. Like, I can't even fathom being able to walk into a room. I have to tell you that I have had a couple people say to me, oh, the Mary Fasher. And I always have to laugh at that because, you know, I've had some people on my podcast say, oh, I feel like I'm meeting a celebrity. I'm like, well, you really are. Sorry to disappoint you. I'm just a person. I'm just the average person. But, like, can you imagine just being able to walk into a room and being someone, and I'm going to throw out Nina's name again because Nina is very well known within the disabled community. When you say Nina came, people know who Nina came is within the community. Like, somebody else who we all know and we love, Dom Kelly. Everybody knows who Dom Kelly is. And if you don't know who Dom Kelly is, you can Google who Dom Kelly is, because Dom Kelly is an amazing example, an amazing advocate, an amazing activist, and someone who always brings his community with him and always has done his best to uplift those who are marginalized and multi-marginalized, including myself.
Yeah, so much respect for Dom Kelly, for his work, for Nina Tame as well. So much respect for them. And they do deserve to be honored, but so do you, you know?
I just, you know, we talk about having that imposter syndrome. I just never feel like I belong. Like, I would never put my name on the same line as, like, Dom Kelly's name. You know what I'm saying? Or the same line as, like, Nick's name. I would always put my name after them, not being side by side with them. I don't feel, I've said this to you privately, I have days where I don't feel like I do much or like my work matters that much.
You do so, so much. And when I'm scrolling through, clicking through your stories, and I see so many community members who are just like, grateful to be in community with you, grateful that you give them the space to talk about things, to be heard, to be seen. You know, I want you to know how much I appreciate you. And, you know, we also have other people as well who are basically our A-list. Like Lachi and Alex Stroker and Lauren Potter, Marley Matlin especially. You know, I would love to meet them one day. But I have so much respect for what you do, and I appreciate your humility. But you definitely deserve to be on all the lists.
I appreciate that, and I want you to know that you really have helped me grow in my own advocacy and become a better advocate, because, you know, when I met you, when we did the politics of disability panel, and, you know, I said to everyone, let me know your access needs, and you said to me, I need someone to voice for me, and that's not something I had encountered yet on my advocacy journey, and you taught me how to meet your access needs. You've taught me how to be a better advocate for someone like you, and to be a better advocate for you. So I want to thank you for making me a better advocate, making me a better activist. And I look at you so young, and I know, Sean, that you already have gone amazing places, and you're going to go to so many amazing more places. And don't forget little people like me when you get there, okay?
Thank you. Thank you. That means so much to hear that from you. And I fully expect that you will be right there with me.
I hope so. And then we can flip off all the haters when we do get there.
Yes. So going into a little bit more specifics about your workshops, what kind of workshops do you do? And is there anything that all of your workshops have in common?
So all of my workshops are disability justice based, period. That's it. All of my workshops are disability justice based. I do different type of workshops. I go in and I go into organizations and nonprofits and say, hey, hi, this is ableist. You're being ableist. Here, let me help you. Let me show you how to change this ableist language. But the one thing I always do is teach disability history, because non-disabled people will never understand why something is ableist or why they can't say something without learning disability history and culture first. So I always lay the groundwork with disability history and culture, and we move into ableism, and I make sure that I focus on intersectionality. You know, I make sure we talk about, when we talk about the 504 sitting and we talk about human, we also talk about Black Romans, and we also talk about the Black Panthers. Like, those things cannot be forgotten. So I make sure that I focus on that. I will say that I have done workshops for two nonprofits that work with physically and intellectually disabled artists. They are art centers, one in California, one in Chicago. I love doing workshops for artists. And we talk about intellectual ableism. When I was younger, I didn't want to be around disabled people because I didn't want non-disabled people to lump me in with disabled people or people who had intellectual disabilities, because people already thought I had one anyway, so I didn't want to be lumped in with them. But let me tell you, I thoroughly enjoy giving these workshops to artists. I did one last week for the Art Center in Chicago, and I did one on disability history and ableism, and it was amazing. It was just so awesome to share space with them. And one thing I will say is, I go in to teach them, but they always teach me something. Like, I have been so adamant about identity first language, which is saying I am a disabled person rather than saying I'm a person with a disability, right? And I did a workshop for these artists a year ago talking about identifying language. And one of the artists, who was Black, mind you, and I think this plays an important part in the story, said to me, I don't want to be called either one. I want nothing to do with that word because of how people treat me. And Sean, that was such a mind-blowing moment for me because I realized that the reason I was so adamant about how I identify and the language I use is because of the ableism I face. And that is why this artist did not want to be identified as disabled or with a disability. And it's like, holy crap, he's right. This is why I'm so adamant about identifying. And this is why those who choose language first are adamant, and those who choose identity first are adamant. Because ableism has shaped our decision and how we identify.
Yeah, yeah. And thank you for pointing out, you know, it's valid, right? However we arrive at our identities, it's valid. Yeah. And I was the same, but there's a difference between the disabled community in schools versus the disabled community in the world, right? Like, I didn't want to be linked with those students because I'm more mentally capable, quote unquote, right?
Exactly. I always had it because people already made that assumption about me. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, I don't want to hang out with these kids because I'm not like them. But truth is, I am like them because we're all disabled. So even though our disabilities are different, we're still disabled. And people still view us the same whether we want them to or not.
Yeah. Yeah. And so you mentioned you talk about intersectionality, disability history, disability culture. Would you say that you have a favorite workshop to give?
I love doing disability history. I love, because non-disabled people are in awe. They're like, really? Wow, I remember. They're in awe. And like the only thing they might know is about the Americans with Disabilities Act, and they don't know that much about it. So I love going into non-disabled spaces and teaching disability history. I have to say, I don't always like going into non-disabled spaces and teaching about ableism, because when I'm there, that's when I face the most ableism. Is I'm there to teach you about ableism, but you're asking me why I'm saying the thing I'm saying, or what justifies what I'm saying. Like, hello? My life experience justifies what I'm saying. You wouldn't hire me and pay me money to come talk to you if you didn't think I had the expertise to come talk to you. Like,
right? Yeah, that part. And that goes back to them so often, right, requiring receipts, you know, for us to be credible.
So I actually did an audit of a strategic plan of a nonprofit that works with disabled people. And the audit was to get rid of all the ableist thoughts and language in the strategic plan. And then I met with the staff to go over my findings. And one of the staff members literally asked me, Sean, Oh, what expertise do you have to do this audit? I'm sorry?
What?
Yeah, really, what expertise? You don't want to check them because I actually worked there prior to me doing this audit for them. I worked there. I said, you know what gives me, I think they said what gives me the authority or some ridiculous shit like that, or whatever it was. I said, the ableism that I face when I work here.
I can imagine their face just dropping because yeah, the like it's you're doing it right now. This is what, like you're doing it right now. Yeah. Why do you say you always say that disability? Oh, one other thing is that so often when they hire us, they also want to underpay us on purpose, right? So my motto is I'm pay up or I'm not coming.
Exactly. And I have learned that I have been undercharging so much that I am not undercharging anymore. Like, this is my price. It's non-negotiable. If you don't want to pay my price, then you can go find somebody else.
Exactly. And you always say that disability is political. Why do you say that disability is political?
Because it is. Because I have said this prior, because every aspect of my life as a queer, disabled woman of color is affected by policy. Is affected by politics. My entire life is governed, no pun intended, by politics, right? So how much I'm able to have on the bank, how much I'm able to work, what I'm paid, all of this is political. My entire existence is political. Me just existing is a political statement. Me existing unapologetically is a political statement. That is why I say disability is political.
Yeah, thank you. And I think you're absolutely right. I so appreciate that you always bring this to people's attention because, you know, we... As much as it may feel more comfortable to separate our identities and experiences from politics, they are connected. It's undeniable.
I do want to say there's a difference between disability is political and disability should not be political. No, it should not be, because there is, there was an advocate, a very young advocate, a while back that said, disability is not political. And when they said that, I about lost my shit. And I was like, no, I get it. It should not be 100% agree. It should not be, but it 100% is. And we need to understand the difference between that.
Yeah. The difference between our ideals and what it should be and what we deserve versus the reality that we're experiencing every day. Yeah, it's important to acknowledge it in order to be critical about it, to be constructive about it. And so speaking of politics, how was it getting to work on the Stacey Abrams campaign and interviewing her for your podcast?
Okay, well, interviewing her was amazing. It was very it took months of planning, and then it was like literally one day I got an email, it was like a Wednesday, and was like, can you interview her on Friday? I was like, okay, sure, I can do that. I can totally come up with questions by tomorrow. No problem. So that, you know, I think people want to make it more flowery than it was. It wasn't as flowery. I more than appreciate her taking time out of her campaign because I was like at the height of her campaign to sit down and talk to me. I got to speak with her, but anytime I've gotten to speak with her, it's been amazing. She's an amazing woman, and as someone said to me the other day, she is too good for Georgia, and I 100% agree that she is too good for this pillowy state that I live in. I 100% agree with that. I love working on the Disability Council, volunteering my time. It was worth it. It was, you know, long hours at night, like doing a meeting every other week, late at night, but it was worth it. I got to work with Kelly, you already know how amazing he is, and a bunch of other amazing, amazing advocates from all throughout Georgia. And just seeing the power that we have, and already knowing that we have this power, and like the fact that, and here we go again, I said this to someone the other day when I interviewed him, I said it become the John Kelly Appreciation Hour, but so has this become the John Kelly Appreciation Hour, but you know, the fact that John would come to me and say, hey, Mary, would you mind speaking at this event? Or would you mind co-hosting this event? That meant a lot that he wanted to center. I keep talking about my speech. Like, I'm so, there's one thing I'm so, like, apprehensive about is, like, doing public speaking, even though I like to do public speaking. I worry about how people will perceive me. And the fact that it never even crossed John's mind and without any hesitation would come to me and say, hey, do you want to do this? Like, amazing. So yeah, I am very, very annoyed, mad, upset that Stacey did not win, but I'm forever grateful to have had the opportunity to volunteer for her campaign. And if she ever decides to run again in Georgia, I will be right there again to volunteer.
Yes, yes. And she is clearly too good. I think she needs to be president.
If they don't want a Black female government, they sure as hell aren't going to want a Black female president. It was hard enough to get Barack Obama in office and get him reelected. But I'm waiting for the day that I can vote for her for president also.
Yes, yes. Anytime she is on the ballot. Yeah, it was amazing seeing you and Dom Kelly and so many other disabled Georgians come together. And hearing the conversations that she's had and how thorough she clearly has been, how intentional she clearly has been in prioritizing disabled Georgians in her campaign. So just knowing that you and Dom were there, and yeah, it's amazing. So cannot wait to see her on another ballot. And so where can people book you?
They can book me through my website, upgradeaccessibility.com, or they can reach out via email, Mary, M-A-R-Y, @upgradeaccessibility.com.
Thank you. We'll definitely put that in the show notes. And can you tell me about your podcast and maybe a little bit about a unique way that podcasting allows you to advocate and hold important conversations that may be less accessible or less effective through other media like social media?
So when I started my podcast, the idea was the same thing as when I started Upgrade Accessibility. I wanted to amplify those stories that weren't being told. And it's like, and at first, again, going back to internal white ableism, I was like, who the hell is going to listen to me talk for 30 or 40 minutes? People are going to listen to 5 minutes and turn it off and be like, this is horrible. But I knew how important it was. I wanted to have a podcast where, you know, like, I mean, if I said, oh, I had a non-speaking guest on my podcast, I'd be like, well, how did you do that? Or how did you have a guest who was deaf or a guest who was hard of hearing or someone who had a stutter? I wanted my podcast to be open to all of the conversations. And again, because disability is political in every aspect. And I wanted to have those conversations that no one was having, at least not from the multi-marginalized ones. So I always call it my little podcast at Curd. We are a 2-member team. And, you know, it won Best Interview Podcast at a film festival. And that is still wild to me that this little podcast that I record in this little room, in this little apartment, in Old Brunswick, Georgia, won such a prestigious thing. It's just wild to me.
Yeah, and fun fact, Adam works for us both here for my voice and for your podcast. How is he as an employee?
Adam is not an employee. Adam is a friend. Adam is a confidant. Adam is someone I can depend on, rely on, someone who turned that Stacey Abrams podcast interview around in 48 hours. And that was just incredible because we were on a tight deadline and her team had to listen to it and okay it and all of that. There would be no politics of disability without Adam. So I am eternally, eternally grateful for having met Adam and being able to call Adam a friend and a colleague.
That is amazing. And was there anything else that you wanted to discuss today that we didn't touch on?
I think we covered all our bases. We covered a lot today, but no, I want to thank you for having me. Thank you for adjusting your schedule to my schedule. Sometimes getting our schedules to link up is very difficult. So thank you for doing that. So I was able to be a guest on your show, and I'm so excited. Yeah, I got to be here, so thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. So grateful for you coming on. This was insightful, as all conversations with Mary tend to be. So thank you for having this conversation with me. And I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did.
It was great. Have me back again so we can start more crap.
Ooh, yes. Yeah, we'll do like a little, we'll do a time capsule check-in. How are we doing with all the crap? So if people wanted to connect with you and support the work that you do, where can they do so?
I'm most active on Instagram. You can find me at Mary Fasik, at MaryFasik, and at Upgrade Accessibility on Instagram. Upgrade Accessibility has a Facebook. I don't really use it that much. And I also have Twitter, but when this episode comes out, there may not be a Twitter. So find me on Instagram at Mary Fasik. I do talk about my own personal advocacy with my cerebral palsy, with my mental illness, with, I want to say, mental health, and with my chronic illness. I do talk about real things that pertain to me personally on at Mary Fasik. And I do talk about more of the collective liberation, the collective advocacy on Instagram at Upgrade Accessibility.
Thank you. And I will definitely make sure to put that all in my description below. And once again, I'm Sean Gold. Thank you for watching. Make sure you like, comment all your thoughts, and subscribe. Also, make sure that bell is on as well. I don't know why it took me over 10 episodes to say that, but I'm learning. I'll see you all next time on another episode of Crippled by Culture.